It's hour number two of the Dr. Future Show.
Hello.
Yeah, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Okay, we're going to take you a little bit back in time, you know, to the mid-80s when the Macintosh had just come out. It was a fresh machine. It offered all kinds of new potential uses, not just for business, but for the world of art. I believe you got involved with that back then, Mrs. Future.
Oh, sure, yeah. I was a Mac evangelist. I had a computer company called Utopian Technology, and I was living in a San Francisco hip commune with a bunch of former housekeepers and gardeners who were very happy to be catching the digital wave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you were able to do desktop publishing, you know, with laser printers and being able to actually do layout and that sort of thing.
Yes, and then we started selling computers, and we went up to John Sculley at a keynote when he first took over at Apple and said, shame on you, you don't have any women-owned companies selling Apples. And he said, gosh, you're right. And so then they got us to be their women-owned value-added reseller.
So that was your slice into this world, the value-added woman's reseller for Macintosh and desktop publishing.
I have to say thanks to Eva A. Konigsberg and Lee Tolp and Shari Tresky and all those people who made that possible. Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, down in San Diego, Michael Gosney had started a magazine called Verbum.
Very first digital magazine published entirely on a CD-ROM.
Mm-hmm. And he was focused on the convergence of art and technology.
And culture.
We're going to track a little bit of how it evolved since then and how this whole revolution that started back then is changing the world today. But we're starting back at the beginnings. So we bring on Michael Gosney, who started that original magazine called
Verbum.
Hi, Michael. Are you there, Michael?
I'm here.
All right, guys. Hey.
Hi.
So while Sun was in her commune in San Francisco doing desktop publishing, you were pulling together this idea of art and technology in a magazine.
This is true. I was down in San Diego, and, you know, I had come through a whole era in the late 70s, early 80s with my small press publishing books. And from early on, I was very motivated to publish important, hopefully evolutionary content from early on. And back then we published Deep Ecology and Holistic Health Journal and things like that. Mm-hmm. And of course, that was actually a very exciting time there in the early 80s because small press distribution was starting to take hold. And it really was a renaissance in the book publishing industry with independent publishers finally being able to afford via short run book printing and the new distribution options that were in place with companies like Book People to distribute to independent bookstores.
There hadn't been independent book publishers before that?
It was really hard because until short-run book printing came online where you could print a couple thousand books relatively inexpensively, it was really beyond the financial means of most independent publishers to produce books, to risk that kind of money. Mm. But even then, I had quickly grown discouraged with the entire publishing paradigm, the way it was working, because it was, like so many things in our world, a top-down proposition with increasing consolidation at the top.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you're seeing another model?
Fresh voices and fresh ideas were not really given an opportunity in that world. And most literary innovations, as well as nonfiction works, new ideas and so forth, were going out in journals more than they were going out in books. That's why early on I was fascinated by the potential of the computers, and certainly when the Mac came out, it seemed to represent the opening of a new paradigm because it consolidated previously separate functions into one process.
Well, so where did you take
layout it? Layout and type design and so forth. I just was very enthusiastic right away to experiment, but actually I began experimenting with artwork on the Mac myself. And I actually created a series of works, both printed just simply on the laser printer, but on really good paper, hand coloring. But I also silk screened some of those works that were done on a Macintosh 512, but probably a Mac Plus is what I was working on.
The very earliest Macs.
Yeah. I had some shows in San Diego, and It happened to be that Apple was having a sales meeting the weekend that there was an article on the show and myself in the paper there, and they were having a sales meeting, and so somebody from Apple called me up and said, hey, this is great. You have to come up and see us. And so that began
my relationship with Apple.
Interaction. And actually, when I went up to Apple, it was interesting. You know, they'd created this incredible platform, this machine that had all these amazing capabilities built in initially, but it also was a platform that promised all kinds of innovations with graphics and art. And yet, they really had no clue. When I went up to Apple, they didn't even know who I should meet with, you know, representing the graphic design world and so forth. I ended up meeting with the art director of Apple, who was a really nice guy.
But he, of course,
he was basically there. He was the in-house designer, basically.
He wasn't Apple. Using the technology himself yet.
Not really. No, yeah. That's how early it was.
Johnny Ives.
Before Johnny, for sure.
Way before. What was interesting, they realized, and I helped them realize that kind of deficit, and they hired us to. And by the way, at that time, I was involved with Step by Step Electronic Design, a newsletter that we started for Step by Step Graphics Magazine. So we were doing this monthly how-to newsletter while we were launching a quarterly, more kind of conceptual design magazine.
Okay, so you're starting to really, the magazine was starting to get into the idea that you could do real graphic art on a computer.
And yes, actual graphic art. Even Macworld at that time, the official big magazine, had no art generated on the Mac. It was all typical editorial.
So it was really the kind of the dark ages coming into the light, so to speak.
A surprise because what began, we were just working with the very basic initial platform of the laser printer, of course, the Macintosh, and its ability to handle the whole screen graphics and then also PostScript. So
you're taking it from
language.
Desktop. Publishing to visuals, desktop.
Well, right. You could use PageMaker via PostScript and print on the laser printers. So that was the very first setup.
Okay, we got to go to a commercial break. So we'll continue.
We had about 30 seconds.
About 30 seconds?
I want you to be aware.
Okay. And
cool.
We'd like you to take this this story arc to the genesis of the digital BN.
Yes, absolutely. I will. So what we'll talk about after the break is how the tools evolved during that very short period of time. That didn't exist when the Mac first came out to create graphics.
Great.
Hey, great. We'll be right back with more on the Dr. Future Show and our guest, Michael Gosney.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking with Michael Gosney on the genesis of art and technology. Michael had started a magazine called Verbum, which was dealing with bringing in the graphic arts into the computer world. The computer revolution really started to go with earnest with the Macintosh and be able to do desktop publishing. And then we're talking about getting into images and visuals. And then Michael started evolving the tools from there and looking at how they could be used. You want to pick up the story from there, Michael?
Sure, absolutely. Well, what was going on at this time, in this very brief period between 1986, when we put out the prototype issue of Verbum, and then in 87, the first actual quarterly issue, from that point through 91, basically, that 6-7 years there, was when all of these tools were invented, and not just for graphic design. We're talking about the transformation of all of the creative fields.
That's when Photoshop came out?
These tools came out. Photoshop, of course. We started with the painting and vector graphics programs, and then we had the more sophisticated Illustrator for PostScript illustration and Photoshop for dealing with
images, pixel art
and images and so forth, and the page layout program. So that transformed the graphic design and commercial illustration fields.
How long did it take for that to go mainstream?
It took about that 5 years. It was by the late 80s that you were starting to see digital art showing up in commercial contexts. But it wasn't really until we got into the 90s that it really took off.
And to get people
In the early days, it was limited to just those artists. And by the way, we're talking about the printing industry and the whole prep business of printing, which essentially gradually went away, stripping. People may not even have ever heard that term. A lot of our younger friends listening, what's stripping? Well, that's when you put together the film to make printing plates to print, and you shot film from art boards that were laid out with wax and type laid down and illustrations pasted onto the board.
That was generations. They just went away from
it.
My commune was putting out a newspaper in downtown San Francisco at that time. We went from an entirely hand-done layout process where everything was glued onto art boards to an entirely Macintosh-done layout process.
You were one of the, like our group down in Del Mar, California, you guys were experimenting with the first productions on this new platform, as primitive as it was. We all saw, wow, look at this.
Yeah.
And it, what was interesting, as creative teams worked with these new tools, and particularly the magazine is great because magazine has always had its traditional editor, art director, illustrators, copy editors, layout artists, printing coordinators, all this. Suddenly all those roles were mixed up because everybody could do everything on the screen. And you had writers doing type design and designers writing copy. And so it required a new kind of organization, a new kind of collaborative environment. It was very exciting in a lot of ways. It was very confusing as well. But simultaneously, while this is going on in graphic design, it's going on in photography. It's going on in video. It's going on in animation, music. All of these creative spheres had the same thing happening with toolmakers crafting the new digital tools for production and distribution of that medium.
Yeah.
And the artists, the creatives that were engaged in the early tool design phase of the industry.
Yes.
And so this is the milieu that we found ourselves in as we began on this journey, which we liken to the Starship Enterprise taking off. Where is this going to lead us in 87? And as the years went by, just those few years, 5 years, it broadened the scope of the magazine. And of course, we addressed beyond those fields that I just mentioned. We covered the emerging hypermedia, multimedia world, which was then pre-internet, only expressed through CD-ROMs. That was the only medium.
Yeah, the internet's a whole nother chapter a little bit further down the line.
It is, and what we're discussing right now is the digital media revolution. This is when it occurred. This is when things went digital. But it's kind of been eclipsed, this era, because of the impact of the internet in the mid-90s, which captivated, as well it should have, the world.
And the cell phones, the convergence of cell phones and internet.
But very true. Yes. But let's go back to the digital tools revolution, because that was completely disrupting many industries simultaneously, as you mentioned.
Absolutely. It was not only disrupting all these other industries, but it was, needless to say, fueling the personal computer world, because until these more involved applications that required faster processing and much more storage space, the PCs didn't need much horsepower. And running a spreadsheet is a no-brainer, you know?
Yeah, but so moving graphics
the file
around.
Size, so they loved, Apple and the other PC manufacturers loved the whole desktop publishing revolution. This Siebold show back then was huge. And
that was a publishing show, right? For people interested
in
digital publishing.
That came from
the Siebold show.
The world of workstation publishing is what that was all about originally. Mm-hmm. But again, just like was happening in animation, at that time, all the animation in Hollywood, high-end animation, was done on Silicon Graphics and the other workstations.
Those are high-end, very expensive workstations.
And it's funny because back then, we looked at that whole world as the establishment, all the higher-end animation.
The mini-computer stuff.
The mini-computer. And we were like, oh, yeah, that's the establishment. We're the new wave here. This is PC art, Mac art, PC art.
And then the Mac 2 was part of the transformation, too.
The Mac 2 was an important milestone that we all were waiting on, because there was no color on the Mac.
Right.
It had created this total integrated cross-media environment with amazing graphic user interface innovations to handle these kinds of applications. We had no color.
Yeah, and white. What's wrong with that?
We were like, what the heck? Yeah. And, you know, the Amiga community, meanwhile, was rocking with color.
Yeah.
It's an interesting, significant side note. When the toaster came out, and you were very aware of that.
Yeah, that was the toaster was for the Amiga computer, not for the Apple.
That's right.
The Amiga.
So you could buy a couple $1,000 Amiga and a $1,500 board and put it in there and essentially have the power of a $50,000 video production console.
Yeah, you started to have video production in a box.
Yeah, all these things are going on. Music, and of course, it was a revelation back then for all musical artists.
Yeah, music went fast, too.
To see what they now could do in their bedroom versus going in and paying $300 an hour in a studio.
Yeah, the big studios started to show the stress of all this, too.
They did. I mean, what would you do if you owned a studio and you were paying off a lease for $250,000 worth of equipment and you see somebody walk in with a toaster and set it down and go, hey, look at this.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So remember when we brought the toasters to Burning Man? We're using them to do the backdrops for some of the bands there, like Lost at Last, and nobody had ever seen that stuff before.
Yeah.
Those live psychedelic visuals.
Exactly. And speaking of psychedelic, that's very much what this milieu was all about, and it's probably an appropriate time to talk about the Digital Bean, which was our party during Macworld Expo in January here in San Francisco. It began the first 3 years as a private party called the Digital Art Bean.
This was during the Macworld event. Now, the Macworld was a very major watering hole for all these artists and technologists who wanted to create creative projects and do amazing things with this technology. So the parties at Macworld were really exceptional.
They were indeed, and a lot of them were well-funded big parties, but ours was kind of the underground party of the cool kids, you might say, early on.
And how was this party different for the
audience? Well, it was, the first couple were basically demo parties where we had some of the different, Zuccarelli, what's his name? The Max program, David Zuccarelli. He wrote the Max MIDI program early on. People like him demonstrating works in progress that later became major standards in the industry.
That characterized
the early ones. And we had music, modern music, and we oftentimes were tying in digital tools and performance schemes, you know, using the technology over the years. But anyway, the concept of a bean was taken from the Human Bean here in San Francisco, which was the iconic event called the Human Bean on January 14th, 1967 in Golden Gate Park that Alan Cohen, publisher of the San Francisco Oracle, Chet Helms, and others helped organize here. And it has a lot of myth around it for good reason.
Right. Now, that was interesting because it really wasn't about technology back in the 60s. It was more about consciousness and the new lifestyle.
No, but interestingly, it was using the equivalent back then of the underground radio and the underground newspapers, of which the Oracle was kind of the grandfather.
Hey, Michael, and this we're going to have to go to a break right now.
Yes.
So hang tight with that. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about the Oracle and that whole era.
The original bean and the digital bean. Okay. What is the connection there?
Dr. Fisher Show. We'll be right back. Thanks.
Great.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking with Michael Gosney about the computer technology art renaissance that happened in the mid to late 80s and early 90s.
And as luck would have it, we had just gotten to talking about the San Francisco Oracle.
Yes, we were linking it to the 60s.
What a breakthrough that was. And Michael, we happen to have here in the studio one of the artists who worked on the Oracle.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, listening to our show here. So
he's the
graphic artist from the...
Well, there we go. Well, the Oracle was cool because it was really not only a model for the underground newspapers that were representing the new culture, the counterculture, if you want to call it that, but it was unique in that they had access to some of the leading poets and writers, the kind of beat poetry circle here in San Francisco, as well as the artists, a lot of the 60s artists who were doing the Grateful Dead album covers and so forth, Rick Griffin and so forth. Yeah, and it was truly multimedia the way it was laid out with all graphics, and they were doing silkscreen printing using multiple colored inks, and it really looked like a multimedia newspaper. I remember thinking that.
And they would have used it if they had the technology, right?
Yeah. The Human Bean, just to quickly summarize what that was, on January 14th, 1967, it was the gathering of the tribes, the local tribes here in the Bay Area. And that was during the, you know, on one hand, the Berkeley radicals were more the focus of a protest movement and not standing by while the Vietnam War went on. But on the other hand, in Haight-Ashbury, a new kind of culture of peace was emerging, and it was definitely influenced by the psychedelic experience. So part of the reason to call the gathering of the tribes was to create a unified front for the counterculture versus being split. It was also a preparation for what everyone knew was coming, the Summer of Love, which did in fact unfold as hundreds of thousands came to San Francisco in that summer. And Sergeant Pepper came out in the spring, and it was just a magical year. Well, the Human Bean was kind of the local tuning for that. And this is where Tim Leary famously pronounced turn on, tune in, drop out.
That was at the Bean?
At the Bean. Allen Ginsberg read poetry. The Grateful Dead played. And there was all kinds of people that were there, even some of our today perhaps more conservative leaders, such as Stuart Brand, Paul Hawken. They were all there. It was an amazing mix of people.
I was there, Michael. They had all San Francisco's rock bands play 20 to 30 minutes each. You know, Airplane, everybody else.
Really something. What I saw happening, being somewhat of an outsider to this scene, even though I had much admired it back when I lived in Kansas City, and then at this time living in San Diego, I was always in great respect for the culture of San Francisco, how it combined the activism and the technology and the green and the holistic health and the consciousness. It's such a vital mix, which goes on to this day. And I believe that that kind of cultural stew of San Francisco is one of the reasons the digital revolution has unfolded as it has.
Is that your inspiration behind starting the digital be-ins?
It was. It's a be-in. Let's get everybody together and let's do look at the human side of technology. And we were all very conscious of that with the Macintosh in the first place, really showing us a more humanistic approach to a computer. And I would say that our culture of all the creative people resonated very much with that.
And so what? So tell us about the first digital be-in and what was that like?
Well, it was a party of a couple of hundred people, and it was at the Masonic Lodge down on Van Ness Avenue. We had different artists demonstrating their programs and different rooms set up. The venue had a bunch of different little rooms. It was actually a recording studio kind of environment. So there was demos going on in all the rooms, and it was pretty low-key. The second year was a little more colorful with more artists and exhibits and things and projections, and ramped up even more the third year. And that was the year, the third year, that the toaster was out. So we had the first digital projections going on and the band Dukuku playing, the all-girl MIDI marimba band. And it was at the third digital be-in that I invited Alan Cohen to come, and he had the San Francisco Oracle reprint, which is a hardcover of all of the Oracle editions in one volume that he released at that party. And so the next year, we thought, I mean, to me, it had become way too difficult maintaining a private party guest list for something that was so sought after.
Yeah.
And we decided we just got to make this a public event and sell tickets. So the next year, I called up Alan and said, hey, we're going to do the be-in. And this year, Macworld is a week later, so we would be doing it on the 14th instead of the 9th or 10th, which usually. And he goes, well, that's great. Well, you know, that's interesting. That's the date. That's the anniversary. In fact, that's the 25th anniversary of the human be-in. And I was like, wow, that's cosmic. And so the fourth digital be-in was called the New Human Be-in. It was the first public event, and it was simultaneously the 25th anniversary of the human be-in and the fourth digital be-in. And that really began the tradition then of the be-ins that we did 16 of them.
16?
As public events, and they became kind of a bellwether for where things were going in the technology space from the kind of more humanistic point of view. And that's really where we were all coming from.
Now, you had the early days of virtual reality back then?
Absolutely. In fact, that was around the time we put out Verbum Interactive, which was the CD-ROM version of Verbum Magazine in 1991. That's when Cyberthon was held. And I was just with some friends the other night reminiscing about that.
Yes, I remember that.
24-hour virtual reality party.
I had met Robin Williams at Cyberthon.
I met Tim Leary at Cyberthon.
Oh, did you?
And I saw Robin, but yeah, actually, maybe I did say hi to Robin, too. Hmm. That was quite an interesting affair. It was definitely a takeoff on the acid tests and so forth in San Francisco. But in this case, it had virtually everyone at that stage that was doing something. Eric Gullickson, Jaron Lanier, most of the companies that were doing the virtual reality
BPL
innovations early on, yeah. Mm-hmm. The kind of whole point of the party is we need to get a handle on this technology and do good things with it and not let it be appropriated by the dark forces. There was a lot of that kind of talk going on there. And it was kind of ironic since already a lot of the research and a lot of what was going on was funded by military.
And that was the concern back in the 60s, too, that the whole peace and freedom and love movement would be co-opted by the dark forces.
Hey, folks, you know, yes, we have a caller. Would you like to say hello to somebody who wants to talk about this?
Absolutely.
All right. Let's say hello to David. Hello, David. Welcome to the Dr. Future Show.
Welcome to the show.
Hey, greetings. I just tuned in this very moment. Who is it you're interviewing?
We're talking to Michael Gosney, who started Verbum Magazine and the creator of the digital be-ins.
Oh, great. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was interested in this. I only moved to California in the 90s, but the SF Bayview newspaper, brought up an interesting thing. They had gotten some Freedom of Information documents out of the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency. And the era that you're talking about, immediately after the 1964 Civil Rights Act, San Francisco was supposed to do a lot of integration, but they were pretty bigoted at the time. And they actually came up with a plan to evict as many of the poor as they could do. And of these Freedom of Information documents that they got from the mid-60s, they had a schedule for how many poor Irish they were going to evict and basically deport out of San Francisco, how many Chinese, how many blacks, how many Hispanics and whatnot, and what schedule they were going to do for a decade or so. And they were basically looking at turning San Francisco into an oasis for the rich. And what threw it all apart was that Life magazine front cover that advertised basically that hippies in San Francisco were developing a new world, a new way of living. And so instead of being able to deport all of the poor from San Francisco, that magazine article attracted hundreds of thousands, basically millions in the long run. And so it threw the old bigots into a real whirl. And I think it's only now, you know, with this horrible eviction and skyrocketing rents again, that we're going to have to figure out some new magnet that will throw their dynamic into a whirl again. Yeah, it's interesting listening to this. I knew Alan Cohen and his wife. And as a matter of fact, I'll just Facebook friend and tell the Annie that you're on the show.
Well, great. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, no trouble.
Any comment on that, Michael?
Well, first of all, yeah, it's ironic that the technology industry that we're talking about, a chapter in this Bay Area-based industry, once again, primarily because all the new young people in Silicon Valley are too cool for Silicon Valley, so they all want to live in San Francisco.
That's what's happening now, right?
That's basically what's happening. So the sky's no limit for rents now, again. I live in the city, and I'm in a house that I don't own. There is no rent control on it, and I've been watching the impact actually over the past couple of years. So yeah, it's Oakland is kind of where a lot of the creative juice is gone because people just can't afford to live here. But anyway, I think that while we have the time, we should
let's get into the internet, how that impacted the digital BN and all these tools right after our next break, which is coming up in a few
Sounds
moments
great.
Here. This is the 20th anniversary of Netscape.
Well, there we go.
We'll see you in a few minutes.
Okay.
Talking to Michael Gosney. Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking with Michael Gosney about the computer technology art revolution of the 90s now, just before the internet hit. That was the days of interactive media, interactive CD-ROM, that sort of thing. We have one question from John, the artist here, who was wondering what kind of 3D tools were used for artists back then for visuals before we get onto the internet. 3D Studio Max, that sort of thing?
3D Studio Max came out a little bit later. Gosh, I can't even remember.
Let me tell you what I remember is that I was asked to do the very first manual, like the printed manual, because I had a print business then, for SGI, right? I think SGI and also Gary Yost 3D Studio Max was probably about the earliest 3D stuff.
That you know of.
That I know of. And there was Vermal, right? They were trying to do the
virtual reality modeling language
for 3D stuff, too.
But there was early things, like even like Silicon Beach, who came out and invested Apple with SuperPaint that had both paint and draw modules and color, you know. They came out with Super 3D. There was things going on, but most of the action was actually on the Amiga early on.
Not the Mac.
Targa on the
Targa card,
IBM,
right.
Targa cards, right.
That's right. I was working with Desktop Video Magazine back then. We were doing Targa cards.
Right. So.
Yeah.
But what was happening was the whole concept of hypermedia, hypertext, which was associative, you know.
Right. Links that
associate. That was new. That was amazing. And Apple, once again, early on, came out with HyperCard, which provided a toolkit so people could create a card, as they called it, which is, you know, a file that had text that could have a link to another card or graphics or whatever.
And that was before CD-ROMs.
And we were actually hooking HyperCard on a Mac up to a video disc player and it became an interactive interface for triggering video disc sequences early on. There was many applications that way. But it was the CD-ROM world, which was over-promoted. That's one of the problems from early on. Yeah. Multimedia was this thing that was coming and coming, and it was supposed to be here, and there was nothing. There was terrible because there really weren't any good platforms to develop high-quality interactive multimedia until Director came along. Mark Cantor's program with his company Macromind out of Chicago. They were from early on, the minute the Mac 2 came out, in fact, the painting module of VideoWorks, as it was originally called, on the Mac 2 was the only program that would run on the Mac 2, and I got one of the first on my block in San Diego. It was the first time you saw color on that machine was when you put in VideoWorks. They had a full working color palette for their paint module of their program. But
yeah,
anyway,
yeah,
so
I remember that. Yeah, Sun used to use that too.
We used that.
Alan and I used Director, having the very first version right after VideoWorks changed into Director for our very first video production.
Yeah, there you go.
Is this Tantra or what?
This was the first authoring environment, sophisticated authoring environment that gave you all the kinds of graphic tools that you would be used to, like in a page layout program and so forth, to create video sequences along a timeline and tie in all the different media elements.
Start to tell an interactive story, because that was part of the dream, is to do an interactive storytelling back then.
Right. But most amazingly was the ease with which you could create buttons and sliders and controls and things, and they all had code running under them, and so you could create an interface. And this was brand new. Only programmers who were designing applications, commercial applications, had that kind of power to create an interface. And actually, by the way, that's what was showing up at this time, too, is that everybody had all these wild ideas on what the conventions should be for graphic user interfaces for graphic design programs.
Yeah, and it was all being made up.
And it was all being made up, and there was all these wacky things that you had to go through, and it was like torture having to learn a new one because everybody was doing it different. And it was only through trial and error and kind of the natural selection process of evolution that the conventions emerged, the ways of clicking on this and dragging it this way and how you make a color palette and all these things. Finally, by the end of the 80s, it all was kind of falling into place. And of course, the major programs were where the action was going, like Photoshop. And there was whole companies that created graphic effects programs that then were obsoleted overnight when Photoshop would come out with a new filter that could do what their whole company was funded to build.
Isn't that amazing?
I mean, that's the kind of stuff that was going on and continued to go on as the operating systems and major programs would, in a Borg-like way, absorb all these functionalities.
It was really interesting to see it shake out. It's like the pre-Cambrian era.
Exactly.
Or so it was like the early days of the car industry, there were hundreds of car companies narrowing down to three, ultimately. We had traditions needed to be established.
That's right. And there's a way that you have an accelerator and the way that you have a steering wheel. There's certain ergonomic conventions that emerged through that process. And same thing going on here. And it's super complex, though, because, again, not just design. We've got how do you do music? How do you do animation sequences? How do you deal with photography?
All with their own language.
I remember I worked with Kodak a lot, trying to help them, guide them into the digital world. And there was so much resistance that the few guys there that were trying to get with the program kind of lost the battle. But they did get the whole photo CD out. I did a whole book on that, the major book with them. And, and that was the first cross-platform format, actually.
And then 20 years ago, the internet hit pretty big.
Well, but right before the internet, the point to get to is that the CD-ROMs finally, since Verb Interactive in 91, which truly was the first robust multimedia CD-ROM that inspired so many people, and there was a few other titles out back then. Mm-hmm. It took 5 years for that new profession to really get refined enough that quality titles started to emerge. And likewise, at the same time, the computer industry was getting faster drives and more storage and finally able to handle multimedia after promising it for years and giving terrible experiences with bad titles and poor performance. Finally, multimedia was ready for prime time by 1993, 94.
Yeah, we had titles like Myst and Spaceship Warlock.
Alice to Oceans.
And so, you know, Netscape came online, and suddenly, before everyone's eyes, the internet emerged. The Noosphere, the first iteration of the Noosphere, made its appearance on planet Earth.
With
and it was
multimedia.
A shot heard around the world. But it was already loaded with multimedia. It was already interactive. It already had digital files.
There
Where'd
were animated
all that come
GIFs.
From?
There yeah, were audio, you know. Playable audio files. Yeah.
Where did they come from, Michael?
Well, it came from this era we're just reliving. For most people, though, it just was all there. It all came ready-baked. It was completely done. The internet was there and ready to go. And it kind of eclipsed this amazing 7 years or so that we've been discussing. And it was interesting, the phase shift that occurred in the marketplace. And I characterized it by this vignette. You would go into the computer store and buy 94. When you're going to buy a PC, it comes with not one or two free CD-ROMs. It usually has like 20 or 25 multimedia CD-ROMs that come with it.
Yeah.
And so that's one of your decisions on buying it, is how many CD-ROMs does it have? That's an often asked question at the computer store. Now, suddenly, people weren't asking that question anymore. They were asking, does this come with the internet?
Yeah. Does it have a modem?
And there it was. That was the transition. And CD-ROMs never, as a medium, as a publishing medium, became anything more than just enhanced programs and informational disks and storage medium and so forth. But the action went to the internet. And for those of us in the creative community, the multimedia community, we're like dismayed because we were set back like 5 years in a way, because the early internet was only low-res graphics and barely a sound. But of course, it changed very rapidly. Our friends down in San Diego, Silicon Graphics, came up with Flash, which changed the web almost overnight into a true higher resolution, faster, more professional graphics kind of environment. What was called Future Splash Animator, a vector-based web graphics system, became Flash, and that made a huge contribution. Of course, so much more is represented by the internet that
changed everything. Oh, there's one comment from Greg Panos who said Cyber Studio CAD 3D was 3D modeling and animation package.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
The Atari ST platform.
Yes. I think we reviewed that in what we called at the time our 4D issue. That was the animation issue.
So 1 minute really, here, Michael. We're going to close it out.
I think that I would finish by saying that in addition to covering Verbum Magazine and the Digital Beans, all the creative revolution that we've been discussing, it was also very much assessing the cyber revolution and what it meant culturally. Our contribution was very much injecting a spirit of humanism, of a humanistic approach to technology back then. And it's
okay. Well, thank you. We got to go right now for the news.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We'll have links to your website on our website.
All right.
Okay. Cheers. Thank you, Mike.
Hey, thanks,
bye-bye.
Michael Gosney. Yeah, this has been the Dr. Future Show on KSEO with Alan. And this is KSEO Santa Cruz, Salinas, San Jose, Monterey, Watsonville. Thanks for listening.